Welcome to the show. Oh my gosh. We're back. We had a week off. I hope everyone had a wonderful Labor Day. And I hope you guys enjoyed the reset of the discussion with dear friend Hua Yutek about that was a tough one. Abusive relationships and how to overcome that and how to find yourself. That was something that was deeply personal for both myself, talking about my ex-wife and all that good stuff, and Hua as well. And I hope you guys enjoyed that, because that was quite an episode. And today, we have something for you as well. Normally when I do these, I have like pages and pages of notes, because, you know, I want to be prepared. I want to lead the discussion, kind of figure out where we're going to go. But today I almost have none, because today I want to listen and I want to learn. I had plans for what we were going to do, what we were going to talk about, but that all kind of went into the recycling bin, because we recycle here, on Wednesday morning, when, about an hour after I dropped off my kids from school, my phone started blowing up. It was my day off, and, the news started hitting about, a school shooting in Georgia. And, you know, I watched it throughout the day, and it's just, you know, the emotions are, I mean, as someone hundreds and hundreds of miles away, even watching that, having kids that are in school, and, you know, it's in Green Bay here, it was their first day of school. So it's like their first day of school, and here we are again, you know. And so all of those plans kind of went by the wayside, because I wanted to talk to someone who is in this sphere, and I don't want to say in this sphere of like, but just someone who works in this arena for common sense gun reform. And I talked to my brother, and he put me in contact with Mr. Jay Walker, who is the co-founder of an organization in New York City called Gays Against Guns. And so he is in this arena. So I do want to give a warm Rational Revolution to Rational Revolution welcome here to Mr. J. W. Walker, the president and co-founder of Gays Against Guns. Jay, how are you?
Hi, Mark. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for your time, and thank you for, you know, your advocacy. I prepared a little bit, but I really wanted, like I said, I really wanted to just be someone who's learning here today. And I you know, looked at what you do. I know my brother, I think, did some of your protests and you know, organization stuff in D.C. And we can talk about all that later. But I wanted to just kind of start to, you know, tell us about yourself and what does your organization do?
Yes. So Gays Against Guns was founded within a couple of days of the Pulse nightclub mass shooting in Orlando, Florida, back in June of 2016. We're New York based. We basically, after the Pulse nightclub shooting, the actual co-founders of Gays Against Guns, Kevin Herzog, John Grawweiler, and Brian Wirth, just sort of called a meeting of our communities at the LGBT Center here in New York. Because for folks who don't know the Pulse nightclub shooting, the Pulse nightclub was a queer nightclub. The shooting happened on a Latino night. You know, it was just a bunch of people having fun, and a incredibly disturbed individual came in and shot up the place, killing 49 people, injuring another 52 people before he was killed by law enforcement. And our community was just sort of reeling. The queer LGBTQIA2S+ communities across this country just reeled from it. And so New York being very much a center of activism, going back to the Stonewall uprising, New Yorkers just sort of New Yorkers and allies gathered at our LGBT center just to talk it through. And out of that first meeting, Gays Against Guns was formed. And what we decided to do was to bring to the gun violence prevention movement something that we felt was missing, which was direct action activism. There were, you know, when we looked at the at what folks who were engaged in the fight were doing, they were doing a lot of great work. They were doing policy summits, and they were doing vigils, and they were doing, you know, doing ad campaigns, and they were doing a lot of great work and meeting with politicians, et cetera. And all of that's incredibly vital. But what we felt was really missing was that direct action piece, that piece where you go out, you protest, where you call out the villains in the piece. And we thought that harkening back to the work of organizations like ACT UP, which just completely revolutionized the American healthcare system just from doing direct action and doing smart research, we felt that we could bring that kind of queer energy and a lot of fabulousness and a lot of glitter to the fight.
That's awesome. So direct action, talk about that. You touched on it. What is direct action?
Yeah, so direct action can take a lot of different paths, but it's essentially protesting. It's essentially getting out into the streets. It sometimes includes risking arrest. Mm-hmm. Other times it is about creating a visual event that strikes a chord in the public consciousness. It can be marches, it can be rallies, it can be a picket line outside of someone who is doing wrong in society, or someone in your group feels is doing wrong in society. It can take a lot of different paths, but the real point of it is to call attention in a very public way to the issue at hand. And that's the focus that Gays Against Guns decided to take in the gun violence prevention movement. We started our first big action, to go back, the Pulse massacre happened on June 12th, 2016, a Sunday, very, very early Sunday morning. 2 weeks after that, as it happened, was the annual NYC Heritage of Pride March, which has been going on since a year after Stonewall in one iteration or the other. And so our immediate choice for our first direct action was to participate in that Heritage of Pride March. One of our city council members, named Corey Johnson, very graciously, since it was so late in the game, we couldn't register to participate because the registration had closed weeks before. So one of our city council members gave us his space in the parade. All the elected officials are near the front of the parade. So that worked really well for us.
That's cool.
And we had someone who was at that first meeting and who participated early on, who was actually a burlesque performer, very well-known burlesque performer named Tigger Ferguson, came up with the idea. Yeah, Tigger.
Nice.
Who's a great person. He had a residency in Las Vegas a couple of years ago. He's really great, and very renowned burlesque performer. He came up with the idea that we have stuck with ever since of representing the people who had been killed by gun violence, who'd lost their lives to gun violence. And in this case, in that first action at that Pride Parade, we had 49 people dressed all in white, everyone veiled, so you really couldn't make out their individual faces, but each one holding a placard with a photograph, the name, and a little bit of information of each of the 49 people who were killed at the Pulse nightclub. Mm-hmm. And it was incredibly powerful. The one image from that year's Pride Parade that was put on the front cover of the New York Times the next day on Monday was an image of some of our activists. We called that project the Human Beings. And we have employed and deployed the human beings constantly throughout the years to represent hundreds and hundreds of victims of gun violence.
Yeah, that's powerful. What was the reaction of people in the parade that saw this?
Pulse was very much on everyone's mind that year because it had just happened. And so we were, the response was overwhelmingly positive. We also did other things during the parade that weren't quite as sanctioned. We did a die-in we did several die-ins actually throughout the course of the parade where we just stopped the parade and we laid down and we did a die-in to just represent the fact that people are killing people because of their sexual orientation. And the response was overwhelming. People really responded. They joined Gays Against Guns. Those early days, we had meetings with over 100, 100 people showing up at our meetings. It's a lot less now. that kind of activism is hard to sustain for a lot of folks.
Yeah, right.
But the other piece is that, direct action activism had kind of waned in a lot of ways, especially during the Obama years, because it's sort of the people on the left, for the most part, felt good about Obama, except for in a few areas. Mm-hmm. But even before that, you didn't see a lot of direct action activism just sort of across the board. It sort of died out after sort of the 80s and the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And what we feel that Gays Against Guns did in a large part is to sort of put a shot in the arm to that approach to activism so that 6 months later, after the election of 2016, you saw the rise in that sort of resistance to some really horrible political ideas and policies, and that sustained a lot of people on the left, for the next 4 years.
Yeah, I think we're going to get to that here in just a little bit as we're up against it. But I think that's it's fascinating to hear, people that are in this realm. And what I want to talk about here upcoming is I want to hear, because I know in this sphere you have contact with people who have been there, and I want to hear some of those stories. And I want to hear how they are affected and all of that, because this is such a huge part of that discussion. So we're going to continue that here coming up on The Rational Revolution. I'm Mark Becker. Welcome back. We're here on The Rational Revolution. And we're talking with Jay Walker, the co-founder of Gays Against Guns. We were talking about direct action and it was, what that is and how that goes. And we're kind of getting into the illustrious 2016 to now era. And, it's been interesting to kind of see where things have gone. And I think, you could correct me if I'm wrong, Jay, but, I think direct action and protests in general, ever since 2016, has really become commonplace.
Yeah.
How have you seen that, since the rise of Donald Trump?
Yeah. Well, like I was saying, right after that election, meetings started happening here in New York at the LGBT Center and other spaces. I joined 3 separate organizations.
Oh my gosh.
that were founded right after that.
Oh,
people were just all in, because we were in, especially in New York, because New York is a very specific circumstance as it relates to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
New Yorkers know him best, especially New Yorkers of a certain age. New Yorkers, say, older than, say, 40.
Oh, sure.
We knew Donald Trump very, very well. We had lived through Donald Trump. He had been in our newspapers. We knew exactly what he was all about in a way that the people in the other 49 states who only knew him from The Apprentice or interviews about his, you know, his ghostwritten books, did not know him.
Yeah.
And so, you know, which is, you know, when you look at the election results for New York, you know, for New York, Donald Trump lost the borough of his birth. He lost the borough that he spent his entire adult life in. He lost the entire city of New York. He lost the entire state by huge margins because we know what he's really all about.
Right.
And so because of that, New York was a very, very fertile breeding ground because, you know, in many ways, New Yorkers were like, oh, my God, I kept, you know, the people, you know, we went from this space of this guy's a clown. You know, no one's going to vote for him. He's a buffoon. Yep. He's a joke. We know this so very well. To as we got closer and closer to the election, as we got to October 2016, it's like, oh my God, what is wrong with this country? Yeah. Do they not see who this person is? And so after the election, all of that just sort of coalesced into this sort of huge resistance movement that New York in many ways led, but that was very broad and national.
Yeah. And it's, which is great. How do you take the message outside of New York? How do you broaden that coalition?
Well, the beautiful thing about New York is that it is one of the major media capitals of the country.
Yes.
And you have to be very smart and very strategic about going to strongly mediagenic locations and events, but also to craft messages and signage that is instantly translatable. And with Gays Against Guns, we chose to really hone in on a lot of very particular messages about what the Trump presidency, what the overall goals of the conservative movement are regarding guns, and very simple messaging that could be picked up. So for instance, one of the things, you know, because I said earlier that we sort of followed the ACT UP model, right? And one of the things that ACT UP did really well is, you know, in ACT UP, there were for people who don't know who are listening, ACT UP is the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. And it was founded in 1987 by people who were just disgusted by what the then Reagan administration was doing about HIV/AIDS.
Or not doing it.
Which was nothing. Which was not even mentioning the word, I think, except maybe once during his entire two-term presidency. And so there was the direct action piece of it, which we talked about already. But the other big piece of it was research, was to like delve into the subject at hand. So the ACT UP activists, they basically split in half. One half focused on direct action campaigns. The other half focused on doing the research into epidemiology, into how drugs are brought to market, into how studies are done, into, you know, all of the different aspects of the pharmaceutical industry and its relation to government, all of the laws that are on hand about clinical trials, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they, through that research that then informed the direct action and got huge policy changes made in the way that our entire health system, especially as it relates to medicine, handles infectious diseases. And, you know, that when we look at COVID-19, the way that the vaccines were brought to bear and so quickly, I mean, in less than a year, we had vaccines that were able to be deployed, you know, around the world. That speed, that alacrity, that enabled that to happen was a direct result of the work that ACT UP activists did to change the way that epidemiology and clinical trials and the entire process of bringing new medications to market was done. So for Gays Against Guns, we, you know, started really looking into all of these forces that had been arrayed against making common sense gun violence prevention legislation able to be passed.
We're talking with J.W. Walker, who's the president and co-founder of Gays Against Guns. What are those things that you do advocate for?
So in terms of advocating, we definitely want to reinstate the assault weapons ban. Mm-hmm. When we looked at what just happened at Appalachee High School, it crystallizes, you know, the way that assault weapons have metastasized in yes. our culture. We have a 14-year-old boy who had the FBI visit his home about a year ago, because they received a tip that he had been making comments or threats or posts about wanting to shoot up his school. The FBI visited his home. His parents said, "Oh no, I only, I never allow my son to be, in the presence of my guns." His father had lots of guns, without supervision. This alleged threat is a lie. He never said it.
Right.
That happened maybe about a year ago. A few months later, that father then gifted.
Yeah, isn't that wild?
An AR-15.
I can't imagine what a tone deaf thing would be. You know, like after the FBI comes and says, "Hey, your kid's doing this. We should really talk about, you know." Yeah. Oh, no. And then, okay, great. He's fine. Here's an AR-15. We're going to continue this discussion with J.W. Walker, president and co-founder of Gays Against Guns, here on the other side. And we're going to talk about some personal stories here as well. So we'll see ya.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for
welcome
a train.
Back. I like this song. It's a good one. We're talking with J.W. Walker, who is the president and co-founder of Gays Against Guns. And we were talking about, you know, kind of what they advocate for. And it's you know, unlike the AIDS epidemic and COVID and all that kind of stuff, the one thing that kind of stands in the way is how people interpret that right to bear arms in the Constitution. You know, and I think, you know, we can talk about that. You know, I am a gun owner. I don't feel the need to have military grade weapons in my home. But I you know, and I think advocating for common sense gun laws is just that. It's common sense. And I do want to talk with Jay about, you know, the stories that you've heard, that he's heard. You know, be it in school or the Pulse nightclub shooting, you know, in that world, you meet people who were there. And so, you know, I'd like to hear from you, Jay, like what I would like to hear some stories of things and of people that have impacted you during this journey that you've taken.
Yes. I'll give you one of the most impactful ones is our member of Gays Against Guns, who also works with other gun violence prevention groups, Antonius Wirajada. And he lives here in New York. He is an immigrant but legal and a citizen. He was just randomly shot. He was walking on a beautiful sunny day in Brooklyn one day, and a man tried to shoot a pregnant woman, his romantic partner.
Oh my God.
And shot her, but also shot Antonius. And he was shot in his chest. He happened to be shot right in front of a local barber shop. The barber ran out and, you know, started applying pressure to his wounds and tried to talk to him. Someone called 911, and the police and paramedics arrived. And when the police arrived at where Antonius was, they immediately became aggressive with this barber. This barber happened to be a black man. And the barber explained, I'm putting pressure to his wound. He's been shot. Wait until the paramedics get here, and then I'll move aside. And they literally started to manhandle him before they realized the gravity. Fortunately, Antonius survived, obviously. And he stayed in contact with that barber who saved his life.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, the barber moved back down to North Carolina, I believe, where he had family. And Antonius, you know, stayed in contact with them. And once Antonius tried to reach out to him and didn't get a response, and he continued trying to reach out and didn't hear anything back. And he had somehow managed to contact this barber's brother and found out that the barber, who had committed no crime, was in the wrong place in the wrong time and was shot to death by police.
Oh my God.
And you know, that sort of encapsulates a lot of the problems about guns in this country. And the way that gun violence intersects with a lot of the sort of the issues and the ills of society. You mentioned earlier that your last program had been about domestic violence,
mm-hmm.
and the presence of guns increases the fatality of domestic violence. The over militarization of police,
mm-hmm.
and the racial attitudes of police that have, you know, that have developed over time, you know, increase the likelihood that a black person in a confrontation with police will lose their life. When you look at this boy that just shot up his school, he was taken alive. Dylan Roof, who shot up the Mother Emanuel Church, another young white teenager, he was taken alive. Meanwhile, Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old playing with a toy gun in a public park, not threatening anybody, not doing anything actually violent, just essentially playing with the toy, not even shooting it, gets killed by police. Guns just sort of infect the broader narrative of American history and in American society in a really, really troubling way. But they also serve to highlight some of the issues that we as a society are failing to deal with.
Yeah, it's interesting and it's tragic. And you know, there's a clip of, I think it's John Stewart talking with a state legislator and was describing that, you know, guns are the number one cause of death for children. More than cancer, more than anything else, but you don't want to do anything about that because that right shall not be infringed.
Meanwhile, they're passing all of these laws children can't go to drag, can't be in the presence of drag performers and transgender kids who want to play in the sport with the gender they identify with are somehow endangering young woman athletes and all of, you know, they constantly use this. It's a danger to the kids. What about the children? The children are in danger for things that actually don't actually endanger children at all. But the one thing that is responsible for more deaths of more children than anything else in this country, they are consistently blocking laws meant to address that.
Yeah, as we're talking with J.W. Walker, who's the co-founder and president of Gays Against Guns, I don't know, you know, I don't think that someone's ever thought twice about wearing a bulletproof backpack to a drag show. I guess that could be something I'm mistaken about. But, you know, and I saw a political cartoon, you know, and it's not a funny one, but it was a school with bullet holes ripped through it. And there was a sign out front that said, this school is protected from, you know, risque books and drag queens or something. And it's like, That's it. That's yeah. totally, you know, what this, I mean, it's so irresponsible. I don't even know the words to really to say it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a tactic, right? It's a long-standing tactic to, you know, if you are trying to divide, pit people against one another so they don't pay attention to the actual threat, that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
You throw something over there for them to pay attention to while you're robbing them blind, while you're not protecting them from gun violence, while, you know, all of these, while you're, you know, not making sure that people are safe from infectious diseases, you know, you put up X, Y, or Z as the scapegoat for any and all society ills, mm-hmm. while you're ignoring the actual societal ills.
Yeah, it's really shameful. And how do you toe that line? You know, here we are in Wisconsin, and I think I talked to you over the phone that, you know, every November we turn into like the fourth largest army in the country with people going to hunt and, you know, do sporting things. You know, I have my concealed carry license, and I am a gun owner, but I think, you know, how do you talk to people that say, okay, I think guns that are regulated are okay. I think guns in the hands of, like, you know, law abiding citizens are okay. But, like, how do you, you know, AR-15s don't belong in someone's home. I mean, how do you further that discussion?
Well, yeah, you know, the interesting thing is that most of the common sense gun prevention legislation that our broad movement, our broad gun violence prevention movement support, are supported by the majority of gun owners. It's the, you know, even when they've done surveys of NRA members, and the NRA is responsible for most of the blockages against these, you know, common sense gun legislation, when they interview NRA members, they're in support of all of these things, of a universal background check, of an assault weapons ban, of making sure that guns don't get into the hands of people with domestic violence convictions or that have restraining orders against them for domestic violence. These are completely common sense, you know, gun violence prevention legislation, and the broad community supports them. And so, you know, we've always had a lot of gun owners that support our movement. And we chose the name Gays Against Guns because we like the acronym GAG. But
nice.
But the reality is that, you know, we recognize that in a country that has more guns in civilian hands than we have people, yeah. You know, guns are not going to get eradicated from this country anytime right. soon. It would be a ridiculous notion to even assume that any kind of activism in any kind of short term, medium term, or perhaps even long term would be able to do that. We have to recognize, we have to work within the world that we actually live in, not to try to get to a world that we want. And so, you know, we generally understand that, you know, there is a hunting culture in this country. We understand that in, you know, rural areas, often you're not just dealing with going out and hunting, you're often dealing with wild animals that can come onto right. your property and, you know, possibly, you know, be predators against you or your family or your pets.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we understand that. The reality, though, is that when you look at the history of what happened to the NRA morphed, you know, in the 70s and 80s, you know, from yeah. an organization that was a gun safety organization that was right. recognizing that people need to have guns to protect their property, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or to hunt or whatever. But the NRA existed to make sure that they were using them properly and that their kids were being trained in responsible gun use, and they had classes and camps and things like that to sort of help keep people safe. And sometime in the 70s and the 80s, they morphed into an advertising firm for firearms manufacturers, because as the American public became more urban, as you know, more and more, a larger and larger percentage of Americans lived in urban centers where they didn't have to worry about wild animals and maybe they weren't hunting as much, gun sales started going down. And the NRA repositioned itself with a lot of money from those firearms manufacturers to become something that would gin up interest in buying guns. And they used race, they used sexuality and gender, they used all of these sorts of hot button issues to divide people and make people feel that they needed to arm themselves for the coming civil war or against crime, or, you know, against whatever, in order to keep those gun sales up.
All the doom and gloom stuff that they so often do. And we have about 30 seconds left, and I want to just wrap it up here with J.W. Walker. What happens here in 15 seconds? What's next?
What's next is to keep doing what we're doing, because for the first time in 30 years in the current administration, we got the first piece of strong gun violence prevention legislation passed and signed into law. All of that work that activists have been doing got that done. And we're going to keep doing it into the next administration, provided that...
Good Lord willing, we don't make that mistake again.
After the coming election.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to thank you so very much for your time today. And I admire wholeheartedly what you do. And it's not easy, especially, I mean, that is with millions and millions of guns in this country, it's an uphill battle. But I thank you for fighting it.
Thank you so much, Mark, for having us on, and keep up the good work and having these important conversations with your communities there in Wisconsin.
Thank you so much, J.W. Walker, president, co-founder of Gays Against Guns. Please do stay in touch, and thank you so much. We'll see you on the other side for my thoughts. Thanks for coming and listening and hanging out with us on the Rational Revolution. I hope you enjoyed the discussion that we had with J.W. Walker, who was the co-founder and the president of the organization Gays Against Guns. I got to Jay from a friend of the show and also a friend of me, because he's my brother, John Becker. And I messaged him and asked if he knew of anyone in this arena. And it connected me with this. And he's done work with, and we didn't touch on it, I thought we were going to, but he's done work with Gays Against Guns in D.C. And I think he was part of one of their protests in the Capitol where he got arrested. And I remember that because he like messaged me and he's like, "Hey, I'm getting arrested tomorrow." I was like, "What?" And he said, "Yeah, this is so." And at the United States Capitol, they have this thing where like you can do a protest and a sit-in or whatever. And it's like, it's a legal thing, but you also get arrested and it's like you make a political statement. And so they say, "Okay, you want to get arrested tomorrow? Oh, cool. That's great. We can organize this and set this up." And I think I believe it was with the Gays Against Guns organization where that happened. And, you know, I said at the beginning that I don't have a lot of notes, and I don't have any really for this segment either, because I really wanted to just, you know, go off the cuff and talk about what I learned and this whole thing, because, you know, growing up, guns were not part of my youth. My dad didn't have any that I know of. Maybe he had one stashed away, but he didn't. My grandpa did. And, the biggest connection with guns that I had was one Thanksgiving. My grandpa hated starlings, the bird, you know, and he had these bird houses, and we had great grandma was on the couch, and all, you know, we're just talking, and all of a sudden we hear this big explosion, and my grandpa comes out of the bathroom, and you see outside and the bird feeder goes up and poof, and he comes out laughing. "I got him," you know, and he shot the starling out of the bathroom window. But he lived out in the country, and that was acceptable, other than scaring the crap out of my great grandma. But we didn't really have a connection to firearms and to guns, you know. And I'm 37, and so I remember Columbine. I think it was like 1999, I believe. And, you know, like my parents are the duck and cover generation, but we are the lockdown generation because of, you know, something unspeakable. And it's always interesting to kind of see where society goes. There was an interview that Jay did a couple of years ago after the Uvalde shooting. And it was, those were, you know, children, and it was horrific. And the interviewer asked him, you know, is this going to be the moment? You know, there's always that spark, that moment in history where it's like, all right, this is enough. And I was thinking about that as I was driving to the studio today. It's like, when is that? Because in that interview, Jay said, oh, gosh, I sure hope so. Because, you know, it really doesn't, you know, everything is horrific, but this is just especially horrific. And I remember watching the news when that happened. And there's always like, you know, times where even if you watch the coverage from the shooting on this previous week, there's people that are coming out that are injured and people that are and but during Uvalde, that didn't happen because no one was coming out. And, you know, it's like, what is that event? And I think of the times and the horrific events that have happened since Columbine. And you had Vegas and Parkland and Uvalde, and who can forget Sandy Hook? And what is that moment? And that's why I wanted to really take this show and talk about that issue. Last week we talked about, I talked about, you know, as school was starting, why do we have bulletproof backpacks, and why, you know, when is enough going to be enough? And I was really overcome with emotion as I watched that on Wednesday, because I knew that it was some schools around us, they were having their first day of school, and it's like, oh my God, really? It's the first day and we're here already. Like, what the hell are we doing? And then I was angry and sorrowful because, you know, I think of my kid, and when is that time when it's the last time I make him breakfast or pack his lunch or give him a hug as he goes to school? And like, you don't want to think about that, but in the back of your mind, it's there because the people in Georgia didn't think that was the case. People in Parkland didn't think that was the case. Parents in Sandy Hook, that's my son's age, they didn't think that would ever be the case, that someone would do something like that. And, you know, I know I've spoken, I talked to Jay about his connection. And one of the people that we were going to speak with was the father of a victim of the Parkland shooting. And he couldn't make it today, but, you know, the story that he has, and he's told it widely, is unthinkable. I never thought that would happen. And when I think about my life, the most important thing for me is my wife and my kids. I could lose everything, but I would still be the most wealthy man in the world because I have them. They're the most important thing to me, full stop. And when I think about that possibility that exists, that someone who has something they shouldn't comes into their school and does the unthinkable, like, there's no words for that. And the fact that we don't do anything about it is wrong. And I want, in this show, if you listen to this show, what I want you to get out of this is you do have a platform, whether you might not have a microphone that I get to speak in front of, but when someone talks about these things, don't back down. Don't stop. Don't refuse to talk about it just because it's uncomfortable. Do you know what's uncomfortable? Guns being the leading cause of death for kids. That's uncomfortable. This problem that we have in our society of these weapons killing our children, that's about as uncomfortable as we can get. And if we don't do anything about it and we don't talk about it, it ain't going to get better. Do what you got to do, kids. Thank you all for listening. And we'll be back next week for another episode of The Rational Revolution. It is such an honor to talk to you every week. I'm Mark Becker. We'll see you.